wanted to sort of celebrate Left Turn Magazine. And then the second purpose is to sort of delve into one of the hot issues that Left Turn and this collective right here, very large collective, has helped to raise about rethinking solidarity. So we hope that this, you know, we're going to start off talking about the magazine a little bit and then transition to talking more about rethinking solidarity. If it's hard to hear at any point, or
is there mics right here?
Yeah, I think we're going to try and steer clear, but if people can't hear, just let us know.
And that's okay for Dan's recording. You guys check.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
As long as Raphael can point
into that. Yeah,
So, my name is Francesca, and I work with Left Turn in New York, and I'm just going to go around this way and have everyone introduce themselves.
My name is Max. I'm another editor of Left Turn, based here in New York City.
My name is Ishanti. I'm with Station Libre, Critical Resistance in Jericho.
My name's RJ. I've been working with Critical Resistance for a few years, and more recently, I'm part of a group of people organizing doing childcare work.
My name's Eric Tang. I've been involved in various movements over the past decade, mostly youth organizing stuff, and recently have begun working with folks around building an activist resource center and training center called Refugio.
My name is Paula Rojas, and I'm part of a collective called Pachamama of mothers, low-income mothers of color in Brooklyn, and also work with Sister to Sister, and through those local things connect to INSITE, the national group of women of color against violence.
I'm Dana Kaplan, and I've been working on criminal justice issues and issues of mass incarceration for the last several years in New York City and upstate New York, and right now I'm working most with supporting an organization called Prison Families Community Forum, an organization of primarily women with loved ones in prisons, and also working out of the Center for Constitutional Rights on a campaign to end the contract between Verizon MCI and the Department of Correctional Services.
My name is Priscilla Gonzalez, and I'm a member of the collective of the Center for Immigrant Families, an organizing center uptown for low-income adult immigrant women of color.
Hi, my name is Adjo Jones de Almeida, and I spent 9 years working with the Sister to Sister Collective and recently have transitioned out. And I'm involved with the Bed-Stuy daycare co-op called Little Maroons, and also with the Community Birthing Project.
My name is Oju Agarwal, and I'm also part of the Center for Immigrant Families. And also I'm part of Refugio and the Community Birthing Project.
Great. So just to give you guys a little bit more background on Left Turn, Max and I are going to talk more about it, and just want to give an overview and pitch the magazine, this current anniversary issue to y'all. Our feature, it's called Reflections on Resistance, 5 Years of Grassroots Reporting. So it features a section called Reflections on Resistance, which is mostly like a state of the movements section. So we ask authors to write about like their takes on specific movements. So there's a piece on the Palestine Solidarity Movement, a piece on the feminism movement, transgender activism movement. We also have a whole section on the prison industrial complex, and also a section on Latin America with analysis about the other campaigns, Batista's new campaign, or their first campaign, and Venezuela, and Chile, and the Occupied Factories movement throughout Latin America. So, and of course, the editorial, Rethinking Solidarity, by a few of these folks here. So that's what's inside, and I definitely encourage all, if you haven't seen it or don't have this issue, to check it out back there. So Left Turn is a national magazine, and it's put together by 6 editors. And we're located in New York, D.C., New Orleans, and San Francisco. And then there are about 15 to 20 people involved throughout the country in other cities also. And they're sort of small left-turn collectives, and they work on things like distribution or putting on local events. And just sort of like doing that local work. All of the editors who work on the magazine are involved in a lot of the movements that we actually report on. So we're all activists, and we call ourselves sort of a movement publication because it's for activists and by activists. So people are involved in Palestine's solidarity movement, the anti-war movement, the prison industrial complex, movement against the prison industrial complex, Latin American solidarity work that we're going to talk about tonight. And for the past 2 years, actually, since we moved from basically like a handful of people editing it, maybe like two or three, to an editorial collective of six, we've grown exponentially. And because we're a national organization or magazine, you know, we definitely have grown. And with all y'all help, you know, we've definitely grown. We doubled our print run, which is now 5,000, which is still small, but it's twice as much actually as 2 years ago. And in the past, just in the past year or so, we've increased our subscriptions by 70%, which is great. And we're in about like 200 bookstores in around the country, from like small info shops to Town Records, for example. So it's definitely been, it's been a great process of growing. And from coming from a place where none of us really knew about radical print media, you know, we've definitely learned a lot. And are far from where we started, but it's sort of, I guess, for where we started from, it wasn't necessarily all about radical print media, but more about the political project. And I think Max is going to talk about our roots in that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's funny, we were just having this conversation because we got invited to do some presentations at an upcoming media conference, and really, you know, we don't really see ourselves really as media activists. We don't really come out of that world. It's kind of new to us. It's kind of scary to us. We see ourselves as activists that kind of inherited this publication and are just kind of excited to continue to kind of put out voices that are out there in the grassroots. Because as you know, most of the publications that are out there are either written by academics, scholars, or at least people who are sort of reflecting from afar on various movements, maybe with a few very good interviews, but rarely are those people on the front lines in terms of actually organizing in these various communities. And I think it's something that we try to bring to the forefront, that, you know, validating those people's experiences as writers, as authors, and as, you know, people that are able to really reflect on their own work without the need of intermediaries, you know, so-called professional writers. That doesn't mean we don't have great writers. A lot of our writers are really amazing. But, you know, we really, like, we encourage activists that maybe aren't always used to writing and putting their thoughts down to really kind of put that out there and to reflect and kind of see what happens with that. And then some, you know, writers, you know, we reflect to really be like, listen, if you want to write an article, you know, talk to the activists, talk to the people who are actually involved on the ground, talk to people in the community that people are organizing with, and get some of those voices. And so the magazine, you know, it's 5 years now. The first issue came out in 2001, right after the FTA protests, Free Trade Agreement of the Americas protests out in Quebec City. And part of the project initially was, you know, to kind of pull together what seemed like a new series of social movements that was on the rise globally, but also here in North America. And, you know, the question of how to do that, you know, and I think still, obviously, is kind of unknown, but I think one of the project of the magazine was like, how about we, you know, we start to get some of these voices down on paper and see kind of what they have to say. And I think, like, over the last 5 years, it has given voice to kind of a new generation of specifically younger radicals who are growing up and kind of reflecting out of practice and relationship to the work. And I think because of that, it's kind of like, you know, we're still suffering in terms of our distribution and everything else just because we're an all-volunteer collective and we don't have enough, like, you know, can't distribute through the mainstream distributors, and we can't get it out there still as much as we want. But we do distribution just by local activists, basically just sending bundles of 20, 30, 40 to activists all across the country and all across North America, and they just kind of give it out to their friends usually, and that's just kind of how it goes. And so we suffer because we really hardly get any money back for it, but it actually gets out to people that we want to get it out to, and that's, in the end, that's what our project is. That's why it's a political project, because it's totally not self-sustaining as a media project, but it is self-sustaining as a political project and giving people as a kind of a resource to use. So I guess the last thing quickly I'll just say in this sentence, this little part, is that I think one of the, I don't know, maybe the one of the reasons for our success, or one of the things that we truly try to put out there, is we try to bridge like this tension between the kind of hopeful optimism that I think the publication came out of in 2001. You know, the optimism of the Zapatistas, of the battle in Seattle around work that has been moving forward for the last 10, 15 years. And putting that together with the very real and very scary kind of post-September 11th climate in this country. But always kind of straddling the two and never, you know, never just putting out a forecast of doom and gloom, but making basically an accessible publication that highlighted really what work was being done against this, except, you know, as opposed to just simply an analysis of all the problems that was out there. And I think that kind of general, like, ray of optimism and focus on the work has, I think, maybe differentiated us, you know, a little bit from some of the other print publications, which are really suffering across the board. As all of you know, print media is totally on the way out. Everyone gets their news off the internet. And so even just to have a print publication right now, it's really challenging.
And just to continue off of that, specific movements that we focus on are movements in Latin America and the Middle East. It's particularly, I mean, in terms of, you know, spanning that same optimism, but also like reality of the war on terror, right? Looking at like the optimism of the social movements in Latin America and the Zapatistas, but then trying to play a role of demystifying the Middle East and actually finding the, you know, the social movements, the progressive social movements that are often, you know, not seen by the left. And really finding those writers to like pull out those stories and give the left sort of an analysis and a framework within which to think and to not reduce it and not be reductive, but see the Middle East and the politics of the Middle East as you know, as complex and things that we need to just delve into and not shy away from, especially in this time of like anti-Arab racism and Islamophobia and all of that. So I think that's another role that we like to play that too few publications are doing right now. And I guess the last thing is, or second to last thing is that, you know, these events are just as much a part of our project and, you know, going beyond the printed word and the internet and our e-communication, you know, the value of really having these face-to-face spaces in which to build relationships and just to dialogue with one another, there are too few and far between. So we hope that tonight will contribute to that. And do you wanna end it up?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just gonna end this introductory section maybe just by reading a few. How are we doing on time? Are we?
Do you wanna talk about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing with the magazine that we usually shy away from is kind of editorializing and kind of putting like the thoughts of the editors out there in every issue like beforehand. Like, this is what we think, and this is how you need to build. Right. At the same time, you know, a lot of people over the years have asked us, well, you know, what are your politics? Where are you coming from? Why are you just putting this out there? You're just kind of putting stories of resistance out there. What is the? You say your political project. What is the political project? You know. And so for this anniversary issue, I think one initial step that we tried to make towards, you know, explaining that in some ways, trying to come up with our 5-year anniversary editorial, which we were really happy about how it worked out. And I was just going to read a little bit of it, just because it's kind of the culmination of a lot of the editor's kind of thoughts and stuff like that, and kind of reflects more what the collective thinks more than what me and Francesca right now can kind of tell you ourselves. So I guess just the last section, the last two subsections, which are revolution and hope in the dark. Under the revolution section goes, there are many challenges facing the left today, in the US today. In order for us to move forward, it is important to have a sober assessment of the political terrain. It is equally important, however, that we do not fall into the trap of defeatism and demobilization. We do not need to put our hopes into the lesser of two evil political parties. We do not need to compromise our larger vision for a series of short-term reforms. As Robin D.G. Kelly writes, we still need freedom dreams. We still need revolution. What this revolution would look like is still far from clear. Like many of today's social movements around the globe, we've rejected the notion of the vanguard party structure as a means to liberate ourselves, as well as the path of social democracy and electoral politics. There's indeed no paved road to revolution, but many unbeaten trails that we've yet to walk. Past attempts at revolution have shown us that true freedom and liberation cannot be imposed nor granted from above. They must grow from grassroots organizations of people controlling and running their own communities, schools, workplaces, and lives. Therefore, at Left Turn, like much of the global justice movements, we commit ourselves to democratic and non-hierarchical organizing as a core building block for any truly radical change.
Okay, I'm gonna end it with our hope in the dark section. So finally, we wish to project a politics of hope, inspiration, and solidarity based both on the rich history of social movements and the visionary work of everyday people coming together to radically transform society. We live in dark times, but it is important to remember that we have the power to chart another course. There is widespread resentment of the Bush administration and the larger political establishment that we can build on in the coming months. The government's criminal response to Hurricane Katrina domestically and the ongoing disastrous occupation of Iraq abroad has made ruling class priorities quite clear to millions of people. The challenge for us is not to simply keep pointing out how bad everything is for people. We have to be capable of building movements that those people actually want to be a part of and feel like they can help shape. For our part, we will continue to provide forums for cross-movement dialogue, debate, and analysis. And we hope that over the years, Left Turn will continue to be a resource to this movement of movements, reflecting and encouraging relevant revolutionary politics and visions in the struggle for a better world. So thanks, Al, for coming out. And I'm going to turn it over to Dana.
Well, first of all, I'm sure that we all want to thank Left Turn for organizing this and hosting us tonight. And I'm just going to kick it off by talking a little bit about what exactly the Rethink and Solidarity series was that brought us here, and just a little bit about why it is that we even thought that solidarity as a notion is something that we had to rethink. Over the last couple years, a lot of different organizers, community organizers who do a lot of local work, went to a few different countries in the global south on various delegations, to Brazil, to Venezuela, to Chiapas, to Argentina, and other places as well. Kind of to participate in a lot of the different international forums that have been going on, the World Social Forum, the World Youth Festival, and also do kind of solidarity movement building work. And, this idea of going to the Global South, I don't think is a new thing at all. Obviously, this has been going on for years, rooted from North America. But I think that we can say that it's picked up a little bit with all these different international forums that have been coming together. And we thought that it was time to kind of create a space to really reflect on that a little bit more critically and say, what does it mean for us to be taking these delegations to other countries, and how does that more critically impact our work that we're doing here in the United States? And so that was kind of the precedent for the series. And we started that dialogue by hosting a four-part series in a community space in Brooklyn, Refugio, which has been mentioned a couple times, which was basically a way to come back, to kind of share the actual stories of what we experienced, and then dialogue a little bit further on what the relevance of that was. And kind of in that vein is how we're opening up the space tonight, just to kind of continue that critical dialogue. And so, I guess, again, the second part of that question is, why rethink solidarity and why is this such a critical dialogue, is that, the idea of solidarity is also not something that's a new thing. That's something that kind of has a lot of different historical roots, whether it's an idea of solidarity amongst working classes, white workers in solidarity with workers of color, workers from oppressed communities, whether that's solidarity kind of looking at a global level, starting from, here where you are and looking out. There's a lot of different definitions. I Googled it before I came here, and the definition that I found via the Google form was different groups of people coming together around common interests, common values, and common goals. And I like that. I think that that's something that, you know, resonates with people. But at the same time, I think that we kind of have to look a little bit more deeply at what that means. You know, common values, common goals, and different people are all actually pretty loaded terms that can obscure a lot. And I think that's kind of what brought us to this table. And, you know, I can speak, I think, first from just my own positionality, which is that as a white woman coming into left organizing and coming into organizing on social justice issues, when I first heard the word solidarity as kind of a way of organizing our work, I had strong reactions against it. Because for me, what solidarity has always evoked has been this idea of, you know, people with privilege going to the third world to help out the folks in Chiapas when they have a harder time going to Corona, Queens to really figure out what's going on there, you know? People doing relationship building with folks in the Global South, yet having a harder time doing relationship building with the people who live a block away from them in Bed-Stuy in their new neighborhood. You know, I think that I've thought about a lot about, you know, solidarity meaning people who go to Nicaragua in the 80s when maybe what we needed to have been doing was organizing against policies in the U.S. that impacted Nicaragua. I've thought about, you know, the history of the New Left kind of giving up a little bit on the U.S. working classes and then building solidarity with people outside the U.S. You know, I hear solidarity, and some of the first things that I think of right now is something, a movement like the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine. And that's not to slam on the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine. I have tremendous respect for the work that they do and have contributed to that work. But at the same time, I know that the people in Palestine are saying, so how come all the people that come to Palestine from the United States are white? And do they think that the only role that they have to play is chasing around tanks? You know, the West Bank isn't Seattle. And so these are some of the questions in terms of solidarity that I think that we have to ask before we really get at what it actually means. But that's not to say that solidarity itself is problematic or that we need to redefine solidarity. I just think that we need to kind of interrogate it a little bit more. And what I'm certainly not saying is that white folks in the U.S. shouldn't be in solidarity. And in fact, I think if anyone needs to be organizing in solidarity, it's certainly the community that I come from. But I think that, you know, there's a level in which we just need to be more critical about what that means, what that looks like, and make sure that when we talk about solidarity, we're not doing it in a way that kind of reflects the worst dynamics of our movements. And I think that those, you know, those dynamics of our social movements and of our kind of left communities here in the United States are internal racism that privileges white folks as leading the movement, solidarity work that is normally defined in a way that leaves it in the hands of those that can afford plane tickets, those that work in nonprofits, those that don't need to struggle at home to the same degree, and those that, you know, are really prioritizing, again, their relationship building in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Cuba, wherever the new revolutionary hotspot is, without really thinking about what it means to prioritize relationship building with the struggles that are going on in New Haven or East Oakland or Mott Haven or any of the other places where there's also really important work going on. You know, I think there's a lot of lefty tourism that goes on, but not enough work. And I guess that, you know, part of this is just kind of the call to engage a little bit more in what are the harder aspects of this solidarity work. And I guess I kind of opened up the conversation with some of the harder questions about it, maybe because it's also the issues that I grapple with. You know, I'm not positioning myself outside of the question of what is solidarity. I think that, you know, 6 months in Cuba in the year 2000 probably changed my life, and I participated in these delegations with, you know, people here, other people in the room, and others to Venezuela, to Brazil, and to Palestine. And I think that, you know, that was important political work. So it's not, you know, it's not to just dismiss this kind of realm of political action, but it's kind of in the spirit of taking it beyond the place in which we've been able to have this dialogue, and I think move us closer towards the goal of really being in a genuine solidarity that, you know, starts from here and moves outwards and really gets us to the type of liberation that I guess we're all talking about. So that's kind of what began to bring us together in this room.
Thank you, Sean.
All right, I gotta stop laughing. First off, I am quite impressed by this crowd. If I can put that in there, you know. Quite impressed by the crowd, right? And very diverse, even in terms of age. My peers are in here, you know. I feel more comfortable now. I'm not just, you know, up here with them folks. How many people here are from the, was part of movements in the 50s and 60s? See, that's what I'm talking about. you know, the thing about what we're doing is it's like Frantz Fanon, I think, said something about every generation got to grapple with these questions around what is revolution and all this other stuff. And, I mean, we did our thing back then, and we dealt with some of these things. We called it solidarity or whatever. You know, we was trying to figure out what was the relationship that we had being from here to other struggles, whether it was in Vietnam, Mexico, Middle East, Africa, whatever. But it's never done in isolation. I mean, whatever struggle overseas that we are trying to find a way to support, it always brings us back to what's going on here, which is why I really like the focus of this, because what concerns me most being, from my position, being like black revolutionary trying to create conditions for the liberation of black folks here, I'm just as much concerned with what is the relationship between white activists to my struggle, as well as what is all of our relationships with trying to end the Vietnam War. And we was trying to deal with all of these questions, and sometimes I think we did well, and sometimes we did very bad. But the thing is that there's no ready-made answers for it. Every generation has got to figure out how to do it better. So it means you got to re-examine stuff. You know, you got to re-examine the concept, like she's talking about, or we're talking about rethinking solidarity. We really do. And we also talking about rethinking revolution. We really do. You know, and we got to even question whether the old understandings of them things were good or effective. Well, maybe they were at some time in history, you know. But it is really courageous to, like, question it when everyone around you sometimes gives off the air of assuredness that, well, you know, this is already written. We already know how to do this. This is the proper relationship. But I can tell you that even during towards the end of the Vietnam War, a lot of us in the black movement felt like we were kind of rejected. We were kind of left hanging by a lot of movements that which we might call white movements, the left or whatever. And so solidarity for us didn't feel like solidarity. Folks wanted to put a lot of pressure on us in terms of how we should conduct our struggle. And I mean, the Black Panther Party gets a lot of attention now, but I mean, like, because we took it to the point of being willing to use weapons, it made a lot of people decide how they wanted to relate to us. Solidarity then became, you know, people imposing nonviolent standards on us, civilized standards on us, and everything. And our struggle seemingly was different from what was going on with the Vietnamese and the African liberation movements and the Asian liberation movements. Why was ours different? So those struggles overseas, because a lot of us had a chance to go there, I wasn't one of them, but a lot of folks now had a chance to travel, they were bringing back these lessons from these other struggles. And they always raised the question, what was the best way to support them? And I know that there was one point where the Black Panther Party had went to the People's Republic of the Congo. And this might have been like early 70s. And when Eldridge Cleaver and others asked the leaders of the People's Republic of the Congo what was the best way that we over here could help them, they said, do your own struggle. The best way that you can help us here in the Congo is to create more struggles within the United States for your own liberation. That's what the Zapatistas said, you know? So why are we still grappling with the same questions? It seems like now people have better understandings of
what solidarity, more effective solidarity might mean. They throw out terms like horizontal solidarity. New, you know, posing something different of a way to give solidarity that is not, doesn't have that parental air to it or that exploitative air, that privileged air that you're not even recognizing. So, I mean, we're in a situation today that we can make some advances over a lot of mistakes that we made in the 50s and the 60s. Not only for supporting movements overseas, but supporting those movements right here within the United States. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if some of you remember, but a lot of our analysis back then was like the black community was like an internal colony of the United States. The Chicano people, Aztlan, was like an internal colony of the United States. Just here, not overseas. And we wanted just a kind of relationship with others within the United States that would recognize our struggles, respect our struggles. No struggle overseas, okay? No struggle overseas can we get away from reflecting on what's going on here with us face to face, with all of our issues here. And that's that, I think, is the important thing about this. I got tapped in.
So before I begin and offer some of my comments, I just wanted to again recognize Left Turn and congratulate them on 5 years. I can't believe it, or even 5 years. I've only been reading it for two. So how about a round of applause for Left Turn? One thing they even modestly left out of their intro was that they were also some of the brains behind the Life After Capitalism conference that happened right before the RNC and that received a 4-star review from the New York Post. So so we should be thankful for that as well. And you're not just loved, Left Turn, in here at home in the United States. They love you in Chile too. A little anecdote before I begin. I was down there during the elections, and I needed some press credentials, but I needed to belong to a press. So I said, okay, Left Turn. And then Max was kind enough to whip off a letter to the Ministry of the Press, and I got my credentials. So the U.S. press was ABC News, CNN, McNeil Lehrer, or is it just McNeil now? I'm not sure, the PBS channel, and then Left Turn. And then when they talked to the U.S. press corps, they were like, well, who wants to ask a question of the president? Left Turn? They were fascinated by the name. And I was, of course, scared shitless. So I said, no, give it to the guy from ABC. My Spanish isn't quite good enough. Anyway, so on that note, when we got together for the Rethinking Solidarity series, one thing that I think is important to mention is that we were looking at the hemisphere. We were saying, okay, what's happening in Latin America, throughout the Americas, that seems like a pattern. And that's another kind of element that I think helped frame our discussion, you know, picking these countries that obviously we went to, but there was a reason. It wasn't just random. I think it's because of its proximity and also because these developments, at least as they're understood by the people in Latin America, these developments are a pattern, a shift, a collective shift that's happening across nation states in South America. So we're in these discussions, and after, you know, three or four of these events, a couple of themes begin to emerge. And I want to just kind of rattle off what those themes are. There are three that stand out. And the first one is that solidarity really means getting our movement together here in the U.S. And I think Dana and Shanti have already elaborated on that. It means really getting or organizing our movement tightly focused and unified here. Two, it means being open to a number of tactics and strategies, meaning that we're not here to claim authority over what solidarity is and what it ain't, but we're saying that just as, you know, the movement in Venezuela is very, very different than what you're seeing in Mexico, we have to be open to the idea that solidarity doesn't mean kind of adopting or enlisting one strategy over the other and then having these endless line struggles over which strategy is best, but really being open to the possibility that local communities are going to naturally have distinct strategies and tactics and can learn and apply different ones at different times. And the third theme that came out of the discussion is that those of us who want to be in solidarity, and many of us who joined the discussions were folks who had on-the-ground work in grassroots communities in New York for several years, those of us who want to be in solidarity have to see our own faiths here as inextricably tied to the faiths of people abroad. And that, I think, was a qualitative difference that maybe set this discussion apart from other discussions around solidarity, meaning that we saw ourselves and our futures as precarious and unstable, that we're not coming from a place where we know that we're going to be living the standard of living we're living for the rest of our lives, that things are going to be stable as they are now. They're not. But we see ourselves as vulnerable, and that the struggles that are happening abroad, the fate of those struggles are tied to our own fates. And, you know, I want to elaborate on that last point because I think it brings together all three points. One of the things that, you know, can happen when you talk about rethinking solidarity is you kind of introduce yourself as the group that's rethinking it, and all of a sudden it's new, right? This idea that we're talking about a new kind of solidarity where our fates are tied to the people abroad. But quite frankly, it's not new. People of color solidarity with struggles abroad, particularly in third world communities, is at least, you know, a tradition that's lasted the entire 20th century. And as an example, in 1946, there was a group called the Congress of African Affairs, and it was led by African-American leaders such as Paul Robeson, and their focus was looking at Africa, and particularly South Africa, and what was happening around apartheid and the colonization of South Africa as intimately linked to the struggle for African-American freedom here. And in 1946, they had 19,000 people at Madison Square Garden who were part of their base. 19,000. And these weren't just folks who just floated in, you know, let me check out what's going on with the CAA. These were voting members who voted on issues such as a resolution denouncing apartheid and the past system in South Africa, 1946. To think that you had 19,000 people in a time where the African-American population was significantly smaller than it is now in New York, all people of color, doing solidarity work is a pretty amazing concept. So what we're trying to do with rethinking solidarity is pretty humble, and is certainly not new. And the CAA is an interesting example because, again, they saw themselves not as saying, okay, what can we do as, you know, subjects and citizens of, or, you know, of subjects, what did I just say? Subjects and citizens of the United States, but what could we do, you know, as people who are global citizens to address this issue? And they really saw their fates as tied to what was happening in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And I think, in closing, the immigrant rights movement that we're seeing right now, before I get kicked again, is, and everyone's astonished, wow, where did all these hundreds of thousands of immigrants, you know, come from? Well, I mean, it's, what I think we have to understand is that a lot of the folks who are taking to the streets see their futures as tied to what's happening in their homelands. It's that urgency, it's that sense that, you know, we can't take for granted being here, that we are actually global citizens and not firmly rooted with the privileges that are afforded by U.S. citizenship. I'm done. Next.
I'm next. Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of the things that drew our series, some of the reflections that came out on the political shifts in the Americas, since that was our focus, and then kind of the lessons that we drew out of that for ourselves and our work here. And so if we're saying what Ashanti said and what others have said, that we're talking about a solidarity that is horizontal, right? That isn't about just what we can, US-based, even local organizers, like how we can support people in other countries, because we're, you know, we are in the brain of the monster, the belly of the beast, and we do have privilege. So it's not to say that that isn't part of the role, our role, and also part of solidarity, but the horizontal solidarity is also the support that we can get for our work here from what's happening in other places, and to really take that piece as really important in solidarity. And if anything, we're getting a lot more out of this relationship than other folks are when people go to Latin America to be like an observer in a, you know, autonomous Zapatista territory that, you know, looks, has a lot of blonde hair, so that when the plane goes, you know, passes by, they're like, yo, we're not gonna hit up this community because we got these observers this week, so we're gonna leave them alone, right? That's a real thing that people do, it's useful. But what we're saying about horizontal solidarity is we have a lot more to benefit in these relationships than we think, and we have a lot more to benefit than we are kind of admitting to ourselves or being open enough to learn from. So part of that is kind of looking at the political shifts happening and drawing some lessons from that to what we're doing here on the day-to-day. So I'm going to put out kind of a very general, some of the political shift stuff that we've noticed. So that a lot of these revolutionary movements from 30, 40 years ago that were doing revolutionary, their movement was about challenging and contesting state power, right? Either through, a lot of times through armed struggle, to topple that state power and replace it with another kind of power, right? That a lot of those either didn't work out, or when they did work out in a few instances, didn't really bring the profound kind of revolution that maybe the people were hoping to bring. And so a lot of lessons of those folks have been to rethink how to build power, not so much as taking over state power, but as thinking about power is also the power that we build with each other, and that starts to become creating autonomy, creating our own power that divests from state power, and that in itself is as much of a challenge to the state as trying to fight to topple the state, right? So that is one kind of shift in a lot of different places in Latin America, not all, obviously, but there's, in almost every single country, there's these autonomous movements building in different ways. Another one of the kind of lessons around these shifts is that in that, it isn't just like strategically smarter politically around the power shift, but it's also the way that we're so good at knowing what we're against, right? We're fighting against all of these things, that we're spending so much energy doing that we don't really have the time or the energy or the creativity or the practice to think about what we're for. So let's say we win the revolution tomorrow, right? How the fuck are we gonna do things? Like, what are we gonna do? How are we gonna do education? We know it's messed up right now, we talk about it, but how would we do it ourselves? Do we know? How would we do healthcare? How would we do childcare? You know, we're so good at trying to point out how the institutions are doing it wrong, but we don't have the time to develop that. Folks are doing that now and are learning through that process. That's another kind of lesson for us. And then a couple of other ones. Another would be to really look at how politics is being done as people got disillusioned from political parties and just kind of inherent hierarchies, even formal hierarchies, formal and informal hierarchies in different kinds of political formation, to really create, not new, but refocus on doing things that would build horizontal power and horizontal relationships, and really kind of push themselves to doing these asambleas populares or consultas, which might seem crazy to us, before making a big decision to fucking talk to every single person in your movement and take 2 years, if it takes 2 years, and then you make the big old move, right? So to really see here, where a lot of times people are like, oh, you can only do that in a small little collective, but it's too messy, too time consuming once you have a bigger group of people. People are doing it with like way more people than we've ever been organizing with, and it works, right? And for some of us here in the Community Birthing Project, Sister to Sister, Pachamama, groups of working with working class women of color in particular, I feel like another lesson for us that we drew was that for us to be kind of important participants in social movements is not that we need to act like a white male worker and get in there and like we're gonna go and do the same kind of fight that they're doing but in our color and our gender, but that even that from who we are and how we live
is also another place to struggle from. And we don't have to extract ourselves from our lives to go be political, but that we make what our life is on the day-to-day the political act, right? Mm-hmm. So that, for me in my day-to-day practice, is one of those lessons, but of seeing people saying it isn't just leaving the community and going to the mountains and getting training or whatever movement way you're going to build, but it's that everyone in the community, children, elders, you know, mothers, everybody is an active person in that movement, because by building this community, that's how you're building the movement, you're building power, so everyone gets to be involved in that. So, and then the last thing I'll say on that is also just from a lot of us doing local grassroots organizing here, feeling like if you really want to build a real base, you know, you really got to be involved in these. It's not because we like it, but you know, you got to do the nonprofit thing. You need the time, you need the paid time, you need the grants, you need to get the permit from the cops to march against the cops, because we don't have the, you know, choice, because that's just the conditions here. Because if we were to just have to be like everybody else, to have a day job and then do our political shit on the side, we just wouldn't have enough hours to build a significant base. So those people that do it on their volunteer stuff, you know, they don't have big enough base. And then we're to really realize that that's not true, and that there's movements that are building, you know, at a mass level way beyond anything that we're building here in the United States right now, and they ain't part of the, you know, nonprofit, and they're not getting a grant to run it, right? So some of those shifts and lessons were some of the stuff that kind of brought us to the conversation of rethinking solidarity. Some of the stuff that, like, we drew out of looking at examples from different countries, and then also the stuff that we told ourselves, like, we really, in this horizontal solidarity conversation, we have a lot to learn, and yes, conditions are different here in the U.S. than in other places, but we're actually pretty lucky to be in these dialogues, you know, and to not even necessarily travel, but just be able to kind of engage people who are right now, if we look continentally, like in a much more advanced place of struggle than we are here, right? And so that was another reason why reshifting how we do the solidarity and kind of put ourselves more in the learner position is so important.
So I was going to kind of build off of what folks have already started to talk about, but there's actually, I think, a lot of overlap, so I'll keep it short. Part of what we really talked about in this coming together of this series was to really learn and share and hear about what is happening in Latin America right now. What are these social movements that are taking over Latin America now, that have been doing this work for a while, and as people have said, what is our relationship to these folks? But also, as people have said, how does these movements inform our struggles here? And I think that there were, just like we started to talk about how do we rethink this concept of solidarity, one of the lessons that we started to think about during this series is how do we start to rethink kind of critical themes that all of these movements are starting to rethink too. So for example, the Zapatistas in Mexico and other indigenous groups that are struggling for autonomy there have really turned on its head the whole concept of power. You know, they have a really interesting analysis of power that is totally different from the way that we've been kind of trained to think about it here. And what does that mean for us here? You know, or for example, after the economy collapsed in Argentina and movements like the unemployed workers movement started to take hold there, they started having a really interesting analysis of what does it mean to be political? What does it mean to do politics? And all of a sudden, a very interesting, and not necessarily homogeneous, you know, but very interesting new understandings, as folks have talked about, started to emerge around that. Is being political going out there and marching, you know, with a, or picketing, or is being political, you know, the way you think about childcare within a community, or the way that that a community comes together to meet its own needs in a very day-to-day way. Is that political work? Is that doing politics, you know? What does resistance look like? As folks have already kind of talked about, is resistance just going out there and fighting against institutions? You know, in the case of Brazil, for example, the landless workers movements have come up with a very different model of doing resistance that is not just about pressuring institutional power, but is about actually creating parallel autonomous societies. So that's a very different way of approaching resistance than the way we've been conditioned to think about resistance in this country. So I think that we really spent some time talking about and learning about what is happening in Chiapas right now, what is happening in Brazil around the landless people's movement right now, what is happening with the unemployed people's movement in Argentina right now. And one of the things that we found is that, as folks have said, is very different things are happening. There isn't one kind of, you know, model that we can just, you know, bottle up and start promoting, you know, here or anywhere else. But that in itself was a very critical lesson that we started to discuss, which is, what is this impulse that we have to have the answer, to have it marketed nicely and neatly, and to start disseminating it? And what does it mean to not have that, and to be coming in contact with folks that are saying, actually, what is interesting is the conversations that we're having. So for example, the unemployed workers folks, there's no, and this is very different from the landless people's movement in Brazil, because the landless people movement is in some ways hierarchical. You know, it's a national organization, you have local chapters, you have yearly congregations where all the representatives come and meet and things are decided. Whereas in Argentina, the unemployed people's movement, there's no one hierarchical structure. You have many locally based organizations that have very different visions of how they're engaging people around education, how they're engaging people around the many money-making projects that they have, you know, and some of those folks are interested in building a more homogeneous vision of what they stand for, and other folks are not interested in that at all, and are more interested in building autonomous small communities that are talking, that are dialoguing, but that are refusing to have just one line or one structure that they all kind of fall under. So these are all the things that we were trying to kind of like pull out and pull apart and say, wow, so what does this mean? Understanding that the real solidarity work is about us shaking shit up in here, you know, so that folks there are not under so much pressure, but that also so that we can start to create cracks in this empire from within here. So then what does that mean for us here? What lessons can we pull? And how can we start to imagine what it would mean to actually apply some of these lessons? And I think that just to speak from my personal experience, what this has meant for me has been A, trying to move away from being paid to do organizing or political work. And that's not I'm not saying this is what people should be doing at all. You know, and it's not feasible. I mean, you have to be in a position of privilege to be able to even in some situations do that, but not necessarily. Like as Paula pointed out, people do it in Latin America all the time, and they have a huge mass movements that you could say here have been totally co-opted by the way that we've become professional activists. So, but for me, it's been the struggle to think about what would it mean for me to continue to be committed to doing locally based work, but not be paid to do it, you know? So that's one thing. Another thing has been to really think about what is most critical in my life right now. Well, what's critical in my life right now has been issues of childcare, has been issues of of how children enter spaces that are about building community and building a political vision, and how we think about education, not just at the level of classrooms, but in the level of community, you know? So, wow, these are the critical issues in my life right now. Okay, so how do I engage with people around that? Not just to create pressure around all the kind of messed up institutional, you know, legislation aimed at making it so that people don't have access to childcare and have a fucked up education, all that. Although that's critical and important too. But how can we also start to imagine what we want, you know, in on a day-to-day level? And how can I shift my perspective on resistance and start to structure my work around building and imagining as opposed to just criticizing and tearing down? And where does the economics piece around, you know, funding play into that? So that's kind of a very all over the place thing, but hopefully we'll have a chance to interact more and dialogue more.
So what I was gonna just talk about kind of briefly is that when we were thinking about this stuff, it was like others have already talked about, how do we create meaningful and horizontal and rethink solidarity between as people living and existing in the U.S. in all sorts of different positions, but how also do we engage with meaningful solidarity here or envision it here, and how has the older version also infected kind of what we experience here, you know? And just kind of like a lot of stuff people were talking about earlier, you know, as people went down to Latin America or went to other places in the world, and I'm talking now largely about like people with either class or race or education privilege, and came back here in the 1980s as a lot of shit was kind of coming down on movements across the global south. There was like the emergence of the not-for-profit movement, right? It was kind of exploding all over the place. And there was also a lot of, you know, what people call kind of the new wave of immigrants, but really people of color immigrants coming from all over the global south also, basically due to, like, shit that the U.S. was doing or the World Bank was doing or other institutions were doing in a lot of places. And so as that started to happen, this immigrant rights movement kind of got named, even though it had existed for a really long time before that. People who were immigrants were organizing for a super long time, but it wasn't an isolated identity. You were an immigrant, you were also a mother, you were also a woman, you were also a worker, and you were a whole person. But within kind of that time period, it became an isolated thing. And people still had people-based communities of immigrants organizing, but because of the whole not-for-profit model, those, you know, outside of immigrant communities were often in leadership, and those not-for-profits were able to dominate resources, dominate visibility, say, like, these are the people in need, right? And it was third world peoples, again, similar to the folks who had been visited before, right? But then kind of it seems like what happened was this image of the quote-unquote immigrant got painted also from like this revolutionary movement that you visited before to like somebody who was just this needy person, kind of in need, and oh, like, I'm doing this for them, I'm teaching them their rights because who else can, right? So it wasn't really within a space of questioning power or privilege or who was doing what or who was speaking for who, and just that kind of carried out, continued this idea of solidarity here at home as perpetuating that idea of us and them, and who is them and who is us and who needs what, and well, we're here to serve, we're here to help, and yeah, it was good intention probably, and everything can be from the best of intentions, but what's the effects? And the effects was that it wasn't always people's stories who were at the center. I mean, and that's And that's kind of, I mean, one of the things we do at the Center for Immigrant Families is begin from our migration stories, right? And not just when we came, but why we came, how we came, what we expected life to be like here, what we found. And from beginning with those stories, it's a really important healing process, but also an important political process, right? Because then our organizing emerges from people's stories. And it seems like if we're going to think about creating horizontal relationships, it needs to be rethinking kind of the structures and how we're organizing, not only, you know, and not only kind of tokenizing, putting people's, you know, the most affected voices at the center, people of color at the center, low-income people at the center, but really rethinking our daily practices. Because, I mean, it's really about kind of one of the things that seems to have been created through not being able to create like a we that really is about looking at power and privilege, but a we, you know, that's not just reliant on us and them and how can I teach them English or how can I do this for them, you know. But, you know, at CIF, one of the projects that we have going on is a project around kind of taking back the public schools in an increasingly gentrified neighborhood. And one of the things that we confront in that particular neighborhood is that a lot of people who are kind of trying to create kind of private institutions out of public schools and will say, well, you know, I can't be racist because I marched down south, you know, in the civil rights movement or blah, blah, blah. And it can't, and so there's this inability to say, well, what are my daily actions? How are my kids being raised? What are my expectations for my child? Or like beyond my 9-to-5 job, how am I actually seeking to integrate all these principles into all of our daily practices? And so I feel like it's not only for some people, but it's for all of us to think about, you know, where we buy our vegetables, how we raise our children, how, what kind of family, you know, what kind of practices we integrate into our daily experiences so we can really create a we that's powerful, that's united and acting out of each of our own positions and prioritizing the leadership of those most affected by shit, whether that's folks in the global south or immigrants in this country, you know, or other people of color in this country. So yeah, I guess that's just one thing.
So building off of what folks here have been talking a lot about, I'm going to actually focus on the first step to building that kind of solidarity that we've been talking about and that we're envisioning, which is based on mutuality and sharing and a genuine and full understanding that our different struggles from our different locations are interdependent and connected to each other. Oh, sorry. as I said, so one way that we begin that process is through self-reflection, and that isn't necessarily to imply that it's an individualistic exercise, but it's something that we can engage in collectively through dialogue, through spaces like this one, where we can come together to talk about and reflect on who we are, where we've been, what we've done, and how, as people who are trying to engage in meaningful solidarity work. And I think that for a lot of us, there's uneasiness around that process, and not just in activist spaces or organizing spaces, but also in many aspects of our lives where, you know, when we talk about or mention needing to engage in reflection and coming together, that, you know, for many of us, we hear that that's a luxury that we can't afford because we're in a battle right now. We're engaged in battle and we're in crisis mode and, you know, we have to confront the day-to-day challenges and issues that the communities we're a part of are facing. And the thing is that it doesn't necessarily mean, like, taking time out, or maybe it does, like somebody was saying earlier, that there can be a commitment to a long-term process if that's what you need to do to get everything, you know, to just get things going, but that process, as has already been mentioned, can be something that you engage in on a day-to-day as you live your daily life. And I think also what's important to highlight or to admit is that checking, part of that reflection process is needing to check yourself, which is really a difficult thing to do because it involves looking at everything and everyone and your relation to others, your relation to what you're fighting to change, and what you're, and your relation to what you're struggling to create. So it basically involves all of our baggage and thinking, and particularly thinking about our identities and our positions that we occupy in this society, whether as people of color, working class folks, activists in the U.S., et cetera, whatever identity we subscribe to. And it's from those different locations we can make a movement, because oftentimes I think there's a hesitancy or reluctance to focus on difference, because then how do we have a unified political agenda? And I think that to have a to have that unified entity that I think we're all, as folks who are living in the U.S. are trying to achieve, that you have to start from the different positions that you're located in, and to be honest about what those positions are. I think that, I mean, and specifically for folks who are engaged in radical social change, that radical social change can't just be about what's out there, like I think somebody else already mentioned, but has to start internally within ourselves and also within our own communities. Because, you know, just in focusing on this particular context that we're living here in the United States, that brings with it a whole set of values and norms, institutions that we were born into, that we were raised with, and that we have to challenge ourselves. I mean, just you know, as a side note, I mean, I as a member of the collective of Center for Immigrant Families, to be part of a collective, I mean, that was a really big transition, because I had been, you know, I was raised here in the United States and had always subscribed to this hierarchical ascending, you know, you start here and then you work your way up, that vertical model that, you know, also implies that you have to, that you may have to step on others to go up the rungs of success, however that's been defined in the mainstream. And being part of the collective, that's been like a daily checking myself, you know, like, am I going out of process? What is process? And it actually has been a really meaningful, and powerful transition, because, you know, it has really required learning how to be a different way in the world. Learning how to be a different way in the world, which is really different for all of us, because it is coming from where we stand, and even where we stand often fluctuates and changes. You know, folks who were in the Global South 10 years ago and are here now, that's a different position. Folks who just got here, and especially now living in the time that we do with all the with the anti-immigrant legislation and climate, you know, folks are in a different position, so we can't even, as those of us living in the United States, can't even talk about a uniform privilege that we have. But so I think that in some ways, I wonder if we can talk about solidarities, because for me that's actually about relationships and the different relationships that we have based on our lives, and the relationships that we build and where we are. And I think that that's one way to begin thinking about how our struggles are actually connected, because we can be honest about what those struggles individually are and then see what the points of connection in order to move forward and begin breaking that us versus them dynamic, which folks had also talked about. And ultimately, again, just to reiterate, work towards a solidarity that genuinely is based on mutuality and sharing and reflection, and from that, a commitment to nurture and support each other while still being cognizant of the different positions and privileges that we may occupy within that relationship.
Hi, so my name is RJ, and I think maybe originally how I ended up here, maybe we all work together in different ways. I wrote a piece in the most recent issue about the Zapatistas, and I was there originally reporting for a group called Narco News, which does online reporting And I think that was really important work. There's not a lot of people that are really doing kind of grassroots reporting, especially in English, about the new things that are going on in Mexico. But that's not really what I'm going to talk about tonight. First, though, I want to shout out. I have four coworkers in the audience tonight, and I'm really excited about that. As Amanda, Belen, Ace, and Jose. And we work for a nonprofit. We do education stuff. And it's exciting for me that they're in the room tonight. And also, we are trying to figure out what to do inside our nonprofit, right? How do we organize? How do you organize a nonprofit? I did union organizing, but not like this. Like, it's totally different. That's something that's really exciting me tonight, is this, that's happening. And I sort of was radicalized after the new movements. I was radicalized. I didn't know about the Zapatistas until like 1999. And sort of was radicalized part by that struggle and seeing that struggle happen from a distance. And then also a lot of my early kind of political formation was a really like massive dose of anti-oppression analysis and people really going hard at looking at white supremacy and patriarchy and heterosexism and some shit that was really devastating for me. Because I think when I first started thinking about things that fucked up, I want to change the world, I imagined myself as an individual. I think I started an organization that I was in charge of. I didn't even have basic conceptions in my head about how to really build anything that didn't have me at the center of it. Because like Priscilla was saying, I mean, you know, it's weird almost because I was raised by a single mother. I was going to schools where most of my peers were black, right? It's not like I even, but it didn't matter. Like I was still locked into that notion that, or maybe even more so because of that. Maybe because I felt like I was gonna do the rags to riches thing, right? And then it was just transferred into the movement, right? Like now I'm just gonna be like something in the movement, like a leader or a hero or something. But talking to a lot of friends, I mean, I think that happens to a lot of us. We bring all that shit with us when we decide that we want to change the world. And so getting hit with all this analysis around white supremacy and patriarchy and my heterosexism and all these things was a devastating experience. I went from thinking I was the shit to thinking I ain't shit. And so, but even when I was totally broken down, you know, I was just like, I can't do anything. I'm worthless. You know, which, I mean, really, you know? Shanti's still thinking that. But I knew that I wanted to change. I knew that something needed to change. And so it was sort of like figuring out what to do now. And something I learned from that other big influence, which was the Zapatistas, was to listen. And so I stopped the stuff I was doing, and I just started listening. And we're still involved in different struggles and stuff. I was always listening and looking for some responses to my dilemma, I guess, which I realized like a lot of people face. And what I eventually started to realize was I found that the most radical, most holistic sort of analyses around what was going on in the United States were coming from women of color, right? And I was reading Angela Davis, right? And starting to hear about what Insight was doing, which is a group of women of color against violence that does all sorts of stuff, doing the analysis around the nonprofit industrial complex, tying in the stuff that Angela Davis and other people in critical resistance were talking about with the prison system, with interpersonal violence. And so as I was listening, I was hearing these voices, and these were the voices that for me, started to hit me in a way that other things have not really hit me. For example, I think that Chomsky is amazing, and I think that he can really break things down. But I never really felt like I was in the room with him. You know, like I never really felt like I couldn't really feel him. You know, and I felt like maybe his book was more useful on the shelf when I needed to pull out that statistic and hit somebody with what happened 40 years ago and how that ties into today, but it wasn't really giving me any direction. And so, coming from Cincinnati, which is where I'm from, we were the Cincinnati Zapatista Coalition, right? And we were trying to figure out how to be Zapatistas in our community. And Cincinnati is really segregated, and, you know, I don't even want to say there's a lot of police brutality, because that's kind of stupid, but there's a lot of police brutality everywhere. But for whatever reason, we were really seeing it. And so we were starting to organize around that. And we weren't just white folks, we were black, white, indigenous folks, there were a lot of different folks in the group, and we were trying to figure out how to do things. So we were doing stuff around police brutality, we were trying to figure out what's the indigenous struggle in Cincinnati, where there's not even territories that we could identify. And we started linking up with the powwows. And we started finding out that there was a movement against the mascots, so the Cleveland Indians. So whenever the Cleveland Indians would come and play in Cincinnati, we would do something there. And we were getting into the global justice stuff. And so we were organizing around, there was a global justice summit in Cincinnati, we organized around that. We were starting to do things and starting to try and figure out what to do. And at the same time, a lot of times our groups would like shatter a lot because the guys would still be doing too much patriarchal shit. And then all of a sudden we find out that women don't want to work with us anymore, right? Or there was like, for me, I had a mentor for me was a black woman from my neighborhood who was an anarchist. Years before I even knew what an anarchist was, we were peers. And one of the things that really knocked me like totally out of this world was when she said she did not want to work with me anymore. And that was one of those experiences that really, and all of this is going on while we're still organizing the global justice protests, while we're organizing the anti-mascot stuff. All these things are happening at the same time. And all were a part of that process. That was all of our processes. And I did some union organizing, and then I eventually followed my girlfriend in New York City. And was trying to figure out what to do here. And I think the really privileged thing about being in New York City is that that Ashanti lives here, really. No, and Eric and Paola and Dana and Priscilla, everybody, right? Like, there's a lot of people here that I would have never have met in Cincinnati. And when we talk about going back to Cincinnati, and maybe we will, maybe we won't, but I think I was exposed to things here. And, 1 minute. All right. I think we should all be abolitionists. I think that the notion of safety and security dominates the U.S. discourse. And so in the same way that the Zapatistas take Zapata, right, they are digging at the roots of Mexico, I think if we start to dig at the roots of the United States, we have to talk about the abolitionists. We have to talk about the struggle against slavery. And I think that it's still with us. We're still every day bombarded with these notions of safety and security. And that abolitionist analysis today is one that cuts that to pieces and starts to say, no, everything this is built on is the demonization of Africans, the demonization of indigenous people, of Chinese folks, Mexican folks, all these things. You start to find out this whole fucking structure, the prison industrial complex, and the whole structure that allows for military excursions is built on this notion of punitive justice and this notion of security that can only be achieved through this punitive justice. So I think whatever work we're doing, I don't think people have to join critical resistance, but I think people can really take into our analysis an abolitionist perspective. I would really recommend a really brief brochure thing that Angela Davis put out a couple years ago about it. Does anyone remember the Yeah, Our Prison's Obsolete. It's a really short, sweet primer. She's got a big book coming out. I don't think I'm going to read it, because I read the pamphlet. It's really good. But also lately, it's funny getting back to my roots, thinking about, like, okay, like, my mother was really radical in a lot of ways. Like, getting back to that lately, I've been doing a lot of childcare. And something I want to encourage a lot of people in this room is to work with the Child Care Collective that Radhika, who's here, and myself, and some other people, Patrick, are starting to organize. It's not like a men's ally thing. It's not a white people ally thing. Anyone that thinks you should be doing child care within this movement and partnering with radical women of color organizations, radical mothers, if you think you should be doing that, you think that might be a good thing to do, talk to us, because we want you. We want to work with you.
All right, so I just want to give everyone a round of applause, and all y'all, can you make some nice speech? And so right now, I just wanted to, you know, in the time we have left, to put it out to everyone here and ask you some questions. So I'm going to take a few questions and then shoot it back to these folks and to respond, you know, to whatever you guys feel inspired to. Any thoughts?
I'll speak up. I'm Elder Hylene Gullah Beamy. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm an elder in the Gullah Geechee Nation. And the Gullah Geechee Nation is about preserving and protecting the our heritage, our culture, and our existence in the southeastern portion of the United States. Gullah Geechee Nation exists from Cape Fear, North Carolina, all the way down to Jacksonville, Florida, 30 miles inland. And I would say, to talk about solidarity in the context of self-determination, which I haven't heard here tonight. And self-determination only means that you have a right to self-determination, a human right to self-determination, to determine how you are to live your life. And in that right, not a privilege, I understand what you mean by America and have privileges and so forth, but you, above all that, there's been international, the community has ratified the right to self-determination, including the United States of America. So it's just something that you do. And I would say that that's what rethinking means to me. And to understand the political model, where we fit in politically, and understand about the shifts and the view of power and so forth. But political, and everything is political. Not everyone has a culture. And for me, self-determination means that if you don't have a culture, get together with those who do have one and become their friends and become a citizen.
Hi, I'm Mitchell Cohen, and I do some work these days with the Greens. And with a lot, I really appreciated a lot of the thoughts that were put out here. And I'd like to, there's one thing, though, that sort of bugs me a little bit, and that's the idea that that came from some of the speakers, that we're still doing things for others, even though other speakers didn't do that. I see it that we're, you know, there's a certain Christian approach that of self-martyrdom, of sacrifice, that we're not in it for ourselves as well. And and I think Dana pointed out really well, that inter-dynamic between what we're doing with others, for ourselves and for the world. And once we lose that, and we say we're doing it for others, even then we lose that whole, we become liberals. You know, no matter how militant we are, we're just liberals. So in that context, there are all sorts of issues. Everybody has a culture. We all have culture. We all have roots. We all have issues that we're organizing around. And as folks put it out, how do we link them up? To me, that's a key thing. How do we intersect them so that we don't only link up separate issues, but I peel back the layers of the issues that I'm working on to find those issues that others are working on within it. And like I'm doing stuff, I'll just give one or two examples, doing stuff around cell phone towers now, right? An issue that nobody really talks about. Yet the people who are really, in Brooklyn, there are two main areas where there's cell phone towers in Crown Heights and in Bay Ridge, parts of different communities, where there's like 28 cell phone towers on one building. You know, and everybody in the building has cancer or neurological disease and things like that. Now that should be an issue. People came to us, they don't know how to organize. They never organized anything in their life. Where do I go? Where do I turn? Who do I talk to? You know, and that's something that we link up with other, you know, we need to link that up somehow and bring people into that struggle to understand, you know, to peel back again, to peel back the layers of that struggle to see the white supremacist dimension of it, the patriarchal dimension to it, and the environmental dimension to it. So that's, and I think we need to do that with every issue. And I'd like to maybe, if people could talk specifically about some of the issues that we're actually working on, as well as this general framework, I think that would be really helpful.
Thanks. Okay, the woman's name?
Hi, I just wanted a question I had, but I know you talked, so many members of the panel talked about learning about the movements in other countries and how they're doing things differently than a lot of the organizations here in the U.S. I just wondered, what
type of examples did you get, and how are you going to use that in your work that you guys are working on here? My question is, I'm proud of the movement of solidarity movement, because I'm from El Salvador. But I have seen the situation that happened in El Salvador, and I can see the situation in Mexico and what happened in the United States. And I sort of agree with some people who said that solidarity is something that is to live in a communion where everybody shares with the same difference and similarities. But I have two problems that I put here there. One is in terms of the problem that you can see the division of different nationalism, to put it in a simple way. Okay? That's one of the problem, because here, while some of you are struggling to support or solidarity with part of the world, then there's another problem in another part of the world. So that's one of the issues that I can see here. Well, if we could see that this issue is not just something that affects the Zapatistas, because they are descendants of their Aztec or Mayan or whomever. It is also affect people who are part of the working class. The class that I think is international to begin with, that shouldn't have borders. Because, I mean, let's face it, which country in the world doesn't have borders? So that's the thing that I think is, I didn't hear tonight and like to see. So in terms of that, I think it doesn't matter where we are, in which industry we are working, we have more in common with other workers anywhere else than we, I could say, are different. Because like the immigrant movement right now, for instance, I mean, we can see two problems right there. Now is a lot of people from Mexico with Mexican and U.S. flags, which is a big danger to me, because on one hand, they join the nationalism that exists in that country, and I don't know whether nationalism is something negative. And on the other hand, it's united in the hands of the class that has the control in the United States, and therefore, they will be, whenever they get citizenship, they will be easier to be recruited, sent to the army, and then, therefore, sent to fight to Iraq.
Right. All right. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
So why don't we, okay, let's take one more and then go back to the speaker.
So Left Turn has done a lot of really good coverage of the anti-war movement. And one of the things I haven't heard tonight is any comments or questions around what the question of solidarity means in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan, maybe Iran, and who knows where else. Mm-hmm. And I work for the War Resistance League. We do a lot of organizing here in the States within the anti-war movement. But one of the things we haven't tackled is what it means to actually be in solidarity with people of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And there's been some sort of sectarian lines put out there that seem pretty hollow to me. So I'm curious what you folks think, what your experience would teach you about solidarity in the anti-war movement and also with folks in Iraq, Afghanistan, and, where it was next.
Maybe on that question of the war, I think that's a really important question. Actually, when we wrote the piece that's in Left Turn, one of the questions to the writers was, what is the first thing that we need to do? What is our main task? And the war came to mind. I think it's a difficult sell to talk about the hemispheric strategy around, at least I'm speaking for myself here. For me, it's a difficult sell to talk about that while this war is happening. When we think about what our priorities are, I wonder if instead of, thinking of how we do intercommunal solidarity with Latin America, we should really be focusing the next, at least 2 years until the this administration passes, 2.5 years, on the war. So I think it's an important question. I wonder, though, whether or not, as RJ put it, there's some listening we need to do around the leadership that's coming out of this hemisphere around like the Venezuela, the Brazil kind of axis. Whether or not there's some leadership coming out of those voices down there that might be instructive around how we, on the one hand, uphold these movements, celebrate them, but then also keep our eyes on this other prize, which is ending the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to, I think there were a lot of interesting questions raised, but just to, not to ignore the other ones, but just to touch quickly on that as well. I also feel very deeply that a critical task of our movement in the U.S. is to work on ending the war in Iraq and is to specifically target the occupations that exist, but in Iraq, Palestine, Afghanistan, etc. But I would say that I don't see that as being distinct from the argument that our primary task is to organize locally. And I think that some of the most exciting work that I've seen the anti-war movement take on has been organizing that's focused on military families and organizing that has been focusing on counter-recruitment work and particularly kind of the communities that are most targeted for military recruitment and has been organizing people on local issues within the framework of how that's connected to kind of military spending and things like that. And I feel like, what ultimately is going to end the war is going to be the capacity to stop it from those kind of feeding points. I don't think that it's such a distinction that we need to adhere to that, you can work on the war in Iraq or you can organize locally and that, oppressed communities in the U.S. aren't going to be focusing on that. In fact, that's the critical juncture of who's really impacted by that war. I see that as coming together very much.
Kind of connecting that point in the kind, I felt like the first two questions, I think there were some, there was a link there. The brother from South Carolina, I thought that was a really important point, the question of self-determination. And then your point around nationalism and capitalism and capitalism as a kind of like homogeneous force that in some way can link us if we look at it in that perspective. And I think for me one of the things that's really really inspiring about what people are talking about, the movements that are coming out of Latin America now, is this emphasis on autonomy, which I think is a similar word to self-determination, and that kind of like, but not just as like a simple, concept, but really having us think about all the ways that we're invested in this system in terms of where we bank, you know, the money we spend on oil, the taxes that we're paying, the amount of money we spend buying new stuff, you know, all these ways. And what would it mean to create our lives in a way that we are truly disinvesting from this society and building something new? I mean, that's what people are doing, you know, in these movements, in many of these movements. And if we were able to start to imagine, I mean, I think there's a way in which it can be so overwhelming that we don't take the leap of imagination, and not just like into some kind of like hippie commune thing that some people are doing it, but how can we do it in a way that is really linked to our communities and that is relevant to our communities, you know? I think that if we can start to do that, then we also get at this issue that you're bringing up in terms of like what the solidarity, how can we really stop this war? Well, how can we stop funding the war? How can we stop paying tax dollars that are funding this war? You know, how can, beyond just it being some random thing that a few people are doing, you know? So there definitely is a way, you know, and I'm not saying this from a place of, oh, well, I have figured out, talk to me, and, you know, but really, like, what would it mean from, you know, can I start to build something with people where we stop buying shit? Can we do that? Like, can we really stop buying, or at least new stuff? and can we start to create networks where we can truly start to disinvest from this, from the society, because that would create an impact, you know?
I think kind of connected to what you were saying, Ajwa, and what others were saying too, I think that it's also, I feel like, for me, about not thinking that, right, because, I mean, they've come out publicly, the government's come out publicly and said, this is like a generations-long war, and so it's beyond Iraq, it's beyond Afghanistan, it's beyond Palestine, right? It's a proactive shit that they have in their heads, and so how do we build our shit for the longer term is really through organizing strong communities of resistance here, right, locally. And I think, like, part of it's also just connected to, I mean, I think one thing that it seems like we really have to catch up with is what you were talking about, Ajwa, also, like, you know, I mean, I think in other parts of, like, you know, in Europe, wherever, people just, like, ask on a daily basis, right, where is this vegetable from? Is it from Israel? Because that's a place where vegetables get brought in from. So asking about not just is it from Iraq, but is, you know, is this shit made in a sweatshop, or how is shit made, you know? And so integrating that into our practice, and just thinking about then what are the local conditions of the war on communities here too, you know, how are people being deported? How are people being criminalized? How does this immigration law hook up with kind of the war on Iraq and the conditions abroad, and how do we take actions locally and build shit just really strong so that it can't be a four generation, five generation war like they're saying, you know?
So I got Shanti, Paula, and RJ, and then we got a sister over here that's going to make a brief announcement. I just wanted, before we go, and we'll probably, you know, in about 15 minutes or so, we'll wrap this up. I know it's getting late. For people that, you know, need to get out of here or whatever, just a real quick pitch to get the magazine, the new issue of Left Turn in the back. T-shirts, we're not trying to take this stuff home with us, you know what I'm saying? Just like, whatever you can do. We're completely funded, literally, by readers, by events, by, you know, donations, small donations by people. So just, you know what I'm saying, put that out there and to pick up the issue in the back. Ashanti.
Mine is probably directed more towards around self-determination and the nationalism, but I think I can best speak on it in terms of my experience, why I wanted to go to Chiapas and check out the Zapatistas. I've been in this since 13, 14 years old. Black liberation, black power, self-determination for black people. That's my number one concern. For me, that makes me a nationalist to this day. Even though most of us know I'm an anarchist, I'm still both of them. If it's contradiction, that's okay. But it's just that my nationalism is not about grabbing the nation state. It's about creating, helping to create the conditions so black people can be free. Knowing that means that the empire's got to fall.
So of course, we got to figure out how to do that. Solidarity becomes very important within the empire here, within the brain here. When me going to the Zapatistas was searching for ways of how can this happen here in my circumstances, what my fight is about. To see the Zapatistas, who are basically Mayan people, brown people of Mexico, take the lead. Not the vanguard position, but just take the lead because of the circumstances of the struggle that they have to come forward. And not try to capture state power, but say they're going to create conditions, they want to create the space for other people to come into the picture to figure out how to make a new kind of revolution. I'm like, that's for me here. That's for me. I got to figure out. Every day in my community, I see the devastation, right? But I know that when there comes time for a Black Liberation Army again, I know what a lot of white radicals and liberals are going to do. Because I know what happened before. I know what white workers are going to do. I know what workers are going to do. I mean, and that is regardless of their color. Because that's what the American working class does. All right, people want to take that and change that, then I hope you can do it. But it makes me feel so desperate sometimes. And I hold to my nationalism because I see what's happening to Black folks, even when we can't get the support that we need from our white allies and others, right? The situation that just happened in Durham, North Carolina, with the Black woman who got raped by the lacrosse team, whatever, you know, and all of the prison industrial complex, this is hitting us. I need to focus on what's happening to our folks, but it is that I am so happy that I have relationships with other folks that represent other communities and other struggles, because we can talk about the mistakes that were made in the past and what we might need to do now. There are political prisoners that have been in there for 30, some 40 years, you know, and it's like, I cannot do anything but focus on that. But I know what's going to happen when other folks through the underground go get them the same way they did asylum. Folks are going to back up from us. But this is our lives. We're facing genocidal shit. So we got to rethink this stuff. We cannot just act like some old formula from the past is just going to work. Or that in us not only rethinking but beginning to practice new forms of solidarity, that we're not going to be challenged in other areas of our life that we never assumed, and which was RJ's story. You're going to be challenged, I'm challenged. The heterosexism, the sexism, the ageism, all of that stuff, because that's what revolution does. You have an opportunity now to change your whole life. And yeah, it's going to be difficult. But I know for me, priority number one is my focus. Number one. No way, I don't even try to. Then, how can we do this together? So that never again do Black people, do indigenous folks, do even workers have to face this class society, this racist society, this genocidal society. We can really create something new. But my nationalism stays, just takes on a different form because it's being formed by so many other different things now.
How
I think that there was a lot of interesting comments and questions, and one that we didn't really address from a sister over here about, you know, so if we're talking about horizontal solidarity and learning, so what are some concrete shit we've learned and what are some concrete shit we've tried, right? And I feel like it's one of the hardest questions to answer. So I guess I can throw out a couple of things if that's helpful, and also a little bit of thinking about why it's so hard. But I know that for the work that I've been a part of in Ajwa, part of the same organization, Sister to Sister, we were doing work with as young Black and Latina women in Bushwick around police sexual abuse and police violence against young women, which is a huge issue that now, years later, comes out in all the papers about these cops that finally got busted, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were doing kind of organizing campaigns, and we were exposed the police for what they were doing, direct actions, you know, documentation, and this campaign against our local precinct to hold them accountable, to keep change something. And we kind of hit a wall of like, well, what is the demand? What are we going to ask them to change? How could we be any better? Like, is there anything they could do that we would feel like we want in this kind of U.S. community organizing format that you have to have a clear target, clear demand, a winnable goal, and an issue specific that you work on, right? It didn't work, you know? And so for us, I think we learned a lot around these creating communities of autonomy, thinking that it's not about toppling state power, but cracking it in small little ways till it crumbles. And that's really what's gonna happen. And that for us, as opposed to focusing our energy on this precinct and these cops, who then retaliated against us in crazy ways, we said, yo, let's think from these other examples and try to create a kind of a liberated territory for our community where we don't turn to the cops for any form of violence, any kind of dispute. We're trying to create community accountability and divest from them altogether, right? It's called Sisters Liberated Ground, has all these beautiful components, and it's been a huge struggle, and you know, a few years later, we're still like in part sub A of one, you know? But it's a vision of thinking beyond, even though I appreciate, you know, you asking us to be more specific on our work, and I think that's cool, but it isn't necessarily cutting it as this issue you work on and this issue you work on, right? Learning that people are working beyond, they don't cut themselves in issues, you know, and they're not thinking about it in a campaign in that way. So I think being able to bring that mode of work is really helpful in whatever thing that we're doing. And so blah blah. And why it feels so hard that to really do that, kind of what Aj was saying, is we're so in it ourselves. We're living it. It's inside us. And when we're trying to think about how we could divest or create autonomy, we're so much more invested, you know, in the empire than a lot of these folks we're learning from. That's how we can learn from them, because they are further away and not so caught up and like entangled. But we are. And so it's like we have this internalized, you know, imperialism and capitalism inside each one of us that doesn't allow us to just do what I was saying in a way of like, yo, we could just say, you know what? We won't shop there anymore, we won't eat there. We're kind of like just focus on each other and trust each other that we can do that. So these practical solidarity things that we saw in Argentina, the recuperated factory movement, where it isn't even about having political gatherings, but like, y'all are gonna take over the hotel, we took over the tile factory, we'll give y'all tiles for your hotel. When we go to that city, we need to sleep somewhere, so we'll sleep in your hotel. And it's very concrete, it's tangible, we're doing actual things, and political work is not just in your brain, but it's in your hands, and you have to do it every day, and it's survival, you know? So I feel like, to me, that's that how that practice comes out here is not how to not be a hippie commune is unlearning our internalized capitalism as we do it. So.
So did y'all?
No. Hi, my name is Yael. I'm from an organization called the Bulletproof for Kenyan Community Development. And thanks to the organizers for giving us time to speak. Especially because I think the framework of the discussion was a little bit different than what we were about to talk about. This is we're kind of like trying to ask for solidarity because we have in the past month, we've been thinking about like what solidarity means to us in terms of like what happens when the movement of third world wants to come to the U.S. to take on the subjects of the that's happening here. Because U.S. and South Korea have announced that they will begin talks on a free trade agreement between the two countries. And the first round of talks will begin in June. And there's about 500 people coming from South Korea to Washington, D.C. to protest and then to try to disrupt the talks. And the FTA between South Korea and the U.S. will be the biggest free trade agreement that the U.S. will sign since the North American Free Trade Agreement. And we all know what happened with North American Free Trade Agreement. And just like Mexico's local economy has been practically destroyed, we feel that same thing will happen to South Korea's economy, and especially with 15 million workers that have fought hard to gain workers' rights, they're going to be turned over to like what's happening worldwide, what we saw almost happen in France, and what we see happening in the United States, which is that their work is being their worker status is turned over from permanent status to temporary status. Mm-hmm. So there will be the 15 million workforce. So the 15 million workers in South Korea are going to become contingent workers within a matter of months. And also with the agriculture, well, the 3.5 million farmers in South Korea will practically become either contingent workers or will become the urban poor, because what will happen is the cheap imports from the U.S. will destroy their local agriculture and food self-sufficiency. But also at the center of this, the U.S. strategy at the center of the U.S. economic strategy is exploiting or tapping into markets in China and India, which has like the biggest population, which means that it has the biggest workforce to produce goods that we consume in the first world.
Sorry, no, just is there something specific, right, that's coming up that you guys want to, maybe you want to just put that out there?
Okay. So we're trying to mobilize people in D.C. We're planning a big rally on June 4th, it's a Sunday, in Washington, D.C. And then also there will be events throughout the week talking about international politics. So like we're hoping to pass on the sheet for people that might be interested. If you could give us your name and your contact info, we could send out more information about that.
Where's the sheet? Sorry, it's really makeshift. I was at something until 8:30, but.
And while they're sending around that sheet, I got someone who just wanted to do a quick addition to that.
We can talk as well, because I'm from Malaysia, and my country is also just announced the intent to sign a free trade agreement with the U.S. But I've worked on free trade agreements before. But apart from people in D.C., I don't know anyone else in the U.S., people based in the U.S., who are actively willing to campaign on free trade agreements related to Asia. I know there's plenty of stuff in Latin America, but as far as Asia goes, I haven't seen a lot of activity. So I'd be open to anybody who has more links.
Definitely. Yeah, so I think U.S. is actually to get into markets and markets in China and India. U.S. is trying to is actively negotiating free trade agreements with countries like South Korea, countries like Vietnam, Thailand, and Malaysia, which are the countries that are surrounding India and China.
So I'm gonna let folks just make final announcements for stuff. I know there's a few things coming up, and or if there's anything like that. Anyone up here that really wanted to get out, just to wrap it up, and just thank everybody again for coming.
So I was serious when I said I want to work with some of you in a child care collective. And we're happy to get together on Sunday here, noon to 3. And you know that Liz Mestris, right?
No.
Talk to Liz Roberts. Rodica, who's right there, is holding up little sheets of paper. So if it's not you, but it's somebody you know, still take one, please. And a lot of the mothers that we work with have really stressed that they'd like to see a lot of men of color in our organization. So especially give a nudge to your friends that are men of color that might want to do this kind of work. And come here on Sunday at 12.
sorry, is this an announcement?
Announcement.
Okay. Yeah, right here.
I wanted the grandmothers to the Grand Peace Brigade who were arrested. But I want to tell you that you're going to be in court this Thursday at 100 Center Street. Cindy Sheen will be there. And we'd like as many people who can to come and support us at 8:30 in the morning if you're going to come just to be in at the trial at 9:30. If you can come, it's good.
What day?
This Thursday. 100 Center Street support for the court.
And just a personal plug then, if no one else is going to make one.
Go ahead.
Everybody, there's an amazing anti-war documentary playing right now at the IFC Theater. It's called Sir, No Sir. It's going to be playing for 1 week from Wednesday till next Tuesday. It's about the untold story of the GI resistance movement inside the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. And if you go there during the evening showings next week, the director will be there, as well as a few of the anti-war vets we're organizing right now around Iraq. So,
I'll try to make this quick. I'm working on a project called Operation Refuse War, which is bringing together conscientious objectors from around the world to meet with COs here in the U.S. in the middle of May. We're having a small strategy summit here at the Brecht, and part of that is going to be a public panel happening on Thursday, May 11th. Looking at conscientious objection as an international strategy to build an anti-war movement that takes into account all the stuff about pulling ourselves out of the machine and really refusing to take part. So I want to encourage you all to join us during that. We're also having a conference in D.C. that weekend. OperationRefuseWar.org is the website. And I'd love to talk to all y'all about how to get involved in that.
Connect?
Just really fast. I'm working with Estación Libre, and I just wanted to plug, we're trying to fundraise money because we have a tour, a speaking tour that some folks are here, they're going to be participating on, and to help fundraise that, there's some silkscreen posters if anyone's interested, they're like handprints, so, you know, interpersonal relationships, so we could fundraise to do the work that we do, and y'all can have some aesthetic things to, have around and bright every night.
All right, thanks so much, everyone, for coming. Thank you.